Welcome to our Halo Health podcast.
We are a physician-exclusive angel investment group that advises, connects, and invests in disruptive healthcare ventures. My name is Ruben, and I'm an oncologist and a Halo Health fellow.
Today, we will be interviewing a Halo Health member, Dr. Karim Jessa. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode. Today, I have a special guest with me, Dr. Karim Jessa. And I'm so excited to start our episode, but please first let me give you a brief introduction. So Dr. Jessa is a distinguished medical professional. He has extensive career spanning over three decades. He currently serves as the Chief Medical Information Officer and Emergency Physician at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, where he has been a pivotal figure since March 2013. In this role, Dr. Jessa chairs at the Health Records Committee and the Clinical Documentation Committee and co-chairs the Clinical Informatics Advisory Group and the Clinical IT Steering Committee. Additionally, Dr. Jessa has been Assistant Professor Lecturer at the University of Toronto Faculty of Medicine since February 2013. He's also a Halo Health member. He works in the community as well at North York General Hospital at the Emergency Department. Today, we will talk to Dr. Jessa about innovation in healthcare and how can we contribute to it as physicians. Dr. Jessa, welcome.
Thank you very much for this opportunity, Ruben. My pleasure to speak with you and share the knowledge that I can that I have with you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm so excited. I think like your career is very inspiring for me because like it is something I want to maybe tailor something similar for me, at least in the future. And I'm interested. So you've held several positions in medical informatics and emergency medicine, including right now your role as the Chief Medical Information Officer. So why you were motivated to pursue this career path?
Great question. You know, I've always been a technology geek. So even in medical school, we all had our little three-ring binders or these little notepads that we used to keep in our lab coats, where we referred to these in our clinical activities so that we wouldn't look completely foolish on rounds, and where we could write notes. And that quickly changed for me when I got my first Sharp 256K organizer. And if I had it around with me, I would show it to you. But I used to put my medication doses right in there. And this is going back in medical school, you know, late 80s, early 90s. And then during residency, we started using smartphones or actually the Palm Pilot. If you remember the Palm Pilot, you might have been too young, Ruben, at that time.
Yeah, I'm too young for that.
So there was the Palm Pilot. And then we used to use the handspring visor, and this would allow us to use like drug databases such as Hippocrates or things like that. So it was really about having information at your fingertips and being efficient. So I was a big proponent of efficiency because as an emergency physician, you could be interrupted many times. And then the cognitive load of that interruption and then coming back in would be really important because if somebody, you were doing an interview and somebody said, "Oh, I just started this medication," you would have to leave the room, and at our time, have to go find in Ontario or in Canada, we had this big blue book called the CPS, and you'd have to find it, find the medication, look at the drug side effects and everything, and then being able to come back to the patient. And in the meantime, being interrupted 20, 30 times, and then coming back and saying, "Oh yeah, what was I talking to you about?" And for those physicians who are my vintage probably recognize this over and over. More recently, of course, it's about communications and being able to find those consultants on call or finding a specialist because the emergency department, maybe you may have a patient of theirs in the ED. And early on in the late 90s, I was a big proponent, and the 2000, I was a very big BlackBerry user, and I served on their healthcare advisory team as well. And I was a big proponent of BlackBerry Messenger because everybody had a BlackBerry at that time. And I created my own little groups of BlackBerry Messenger for physicians because I knew it was secure. And very I was cool. able to send information and images with surgeons across the world, potentially if they were on vacation and their patients showed up in my ED, I would be able to set up follow-up appointments with them as well. So, you know, very, very trying to be on the cutting edge of those things. So really improving clinical efficiency and decreasing cognitive load. That's how I got into it. And then, of course, with EMRs and EHRs, when I was in the Middle East for a while, I was in their implementation of their electronic health record, learned how to do these things. Then when I came back to Canada in the early 2000s, I was at McKenzie Health Hospital, and then became a sort of a physician IT advisor and parlayed that into a CMIO role. So really always being at the forefront of understanding how can I help a clinician do their job better.
I love your answer. And I was wondering, what advice would you give for someone in my stage where, like, just starting clinical work or becoming an attending, and they have a strong interest in IT and decreasing the burden on physicians? How can we get similar positions?
So I think with in the US, it's a little bit more advanced with clinical informatics, having a specialty in clinical informatics. In Canada, clinical informatics is not generally recognized. It's not a pathway through the subspecialties and through the Royal College. I'm working on that as well, through a separate venture that we're doing. And I'm cautiously optimistic in the next few years, we'll have a pathway for those clinicians who are interested in informatics, in AI, in improving their clinical workflows, will be able to get some recognition. Because I think it's really important for us not to be doing this off the side of our desks, to be actually be compensated, because this is an important pathway. Even with the CanMeds criteria and the new CanMeds med learner profiles, you know, the appropriate use and appropriate allocation of resources is within our purview, and we should be trained for that. And then further on, as we get into practice, being compensated for it. So what would I say about getting involved early is find out those pebbles in the shoes that you have while doing your clinical work, make notes of them, and then connect with your CMIO, with your super user in your division, your department, and say, no, this is, I think we could do this better. I think we could do this better. You know, trying to do it on your own, although it can be done, but in academic centers or in hospitals, it's much more difficult because you have a bureaucracy to go through. You have a process to go through and a right process, you know, making sure that you have appropriate cybersecurity, appropriate interoperability, that you're not going to be compromising your organization. So get involved often, early. And I've mentored many, many students or residents who have then gone on to have careers in CI, clinical informatics as well.
That's very inspiring. I think that's great. I think just reaching out to people and showing interest, it plays a big role. Just saying, hey, I'm here. Maybe I can help and do something better. Because also, like, on the other hand, like, me and you are interested, and some physicians are interested, but it's not something that interests many people. Physicians are more mostly, which is their job, like, interested in clinical medicine. But I think, yeah, can knocking doors, I would say, maybe it's the right path.
And yeah, I think, Ruben, sorry to interrupt, but you know, I think clinicians, they do want to see their patients. But if you can show them, like, you don't know what you don't know.
Correct.
So our role as clinical informaticians is to reach out to them and say, you know, you can do this better.
And I agree.
And a lot of tools, there are tools in your EMR that will help you find out how your clinician colleagues are doing in certain areas. For example, note size or spending time after hours, you know, what they call the pajama time after 7 p.m., you know, making sure that we're doing things appropriately. And now with Gen AI coming in, there may be some opportunities for us to be able to be doing even a better job. So clinicians are not averse to change. I think that's a fallacy. I think we are averse to less meaningful change. And if you show us change that will help us improve the patient care that we deliver, or to improve the quality of our lives or the quality of the patient's lives, I think they're more than happy to do these things, because change is hard. You know, healthcare, we've been doing things the same way for a long time.
I completely agree. And talking about Gen AI and innovation in healthcare, you have a huge experience in digital health and electronic medical records. So in your opinion, digital health is very broad, but like in your opinion right now, what are the most solutions that are lacking in the market that we really need to implement in healthcare, whether it's Gen AI, whether it's digital health product? Like, if I give you the opportunity right now to fix things, what are the things that you want to focus on?
So it's a great question. The gaps that we see, if we just make it a note of all those things that give us problems during our clinical activities, and you know, I practice emergency medicine still regularly, and you do as well, and you know those issues. You know, whether it's communication issues. How do I find out who's on call? These are not huge, difficult things. You know, how do I find out who's on call? How do I connect with them? You know, what is our connection system? Are we still using physical pagers? Are clinicians have a communications app on their phone? You know, there's texting, there's other things that you can do, but these are not PHI compliant. So your organization will have implemented whatever solution they have for communications. So making sure that those things are there. You know, I think healthcare is, at the end of the day, an information processing activity. You gather through history, through physical, through lab work, through research, all this information about a patient or a condition, and then you have to synthesize it, and then you have to provide a case or at least a treatment plan for your patient. So any tool that can help with that information gathering is really, really important. And I think that's where AI can help us as well. You know, I think there's some EMRs who are looking at chart summarization. So getting information from different areas of the chart, which is great when you're within a closed environment. But in Ontario, in Canada here, we have disparate systems of information. So one of the big gaps we have is interoperability.
Yeah.
So we've got so many different systems. We've got different standards. So how do we get information from one hospital who's using one EMR to another hospital? We have something called the ACCDR, which is the Clinical Data Repository Connecting Ontario, Clinical Connect, anything like that in Ontario. But these are all sort of PDF information that you have to hunt and peck. You have Correct. To get into Connecting Ontario. Now, there's accessibility issues. Is your username and password working? How often do you have to update these things? You know, do you have single sign-on through your EMR? Many places do. But now that you're in there, now you have to spend the time to go through it. Wouldn't it be amazing if you could use AI to go through all that information and give you a cumulative patient profile right there? And I think the ministry would be interested in doing these things. And we have to advocate appropriately and have them allocate those resources appropriately. So even DI information, diagnostic imaging, what you see in the hospitals is different from you don't have access to diagnostic imaging reports from the independent health facilities, from, you know, from Life Labs or from Gamma Dynacare or any things like that, or KMH or any of these other imaging facilities. What's being done about that? How can we do that? And then the holy grail from that is, Rupen, if I see a patient in the emergency department, how can I be prompted that at the time, even before I ordered a chest x-ray or a CT scan, that this patient had a chest x-ray a week ago or a CT scan 2 weeks ago? Do you want to review those results before ordering another test? Because once that test has been ordered, very, very difficult to pull that back because it's not in the best interest of the organization of the hospital or of the radiologist who gets that study to cancel it, right? Because there's incentives for that. But the ministry should be able to look at that and say, let's try to decrease test ordering or duplicative tests. Not only that, but the radiation burden to the patient potentially. Because the patients may not always be forthright to say that they just did that test because they might think, oh, I got this test done a week ago. It might be a good thing to get another test done. So I think it's information collaboration and information sharing And then having that built into clinical decision support. So finding current medication lists. I could go on for hours about this, by the way.
Yes. But,
you know, having accurate medication lists on patients and getting the patient actually involved in that. So the use of patient portals. In the US, they've mandated patient portals to be done. In Canada, this is not happening ubiquitously. So why can't the patient update their own patient profile?
That's right.
While they're waiting in the emergency department.
They are the best source of the info.
Right, exactly. So, you know, update your health information. Make it available so that when they come into the emergency department, I might be able to see it. Now, some EMRs, Epic, for instance, has MyChart, and MyChart has that ability to do that. But other EMRs don't have that. Meditech, yeah. Cerner, less so, yeah. And to be able to do, or Oracle, sorry, less so. But I think we need to get to that, and make the patient part of the solution. And explain to them why it might be important. It might be decreased, you know, more accurate information for them, potential a decreased ER visit, a length of stay potentially.
I completely agree. I think like it is one of the problems that we all face. Like it's not only the time that we spend in front of the screen, it's documentation. Like half of it, it's summarization, like reading multiple sources of information, going through PDFs. And for example, I went through a procedure, one-day procedure, 2 weeks ago in XYZ hospital, and then I asked for my medical records. They sent me 86 page discharge summary, and it's all like repeated redundant things that I really don't want to know. Like just tell me the results of the pathology or the blood work or whatever it is. So I completely agree with you. It is like summarization is a great, the medication it's another issue that we always get called by pharmacy. So for making sure the medications are correct. But you mentioned in your talk that the Ministry of Health should be incentivized to do this. Sometimes, in my opinion, big organizations have difficulty in moving, and that's where the startup role comes in, because like they are smaller teams, they are better at execution. So I want to shift gears and talk a bit about startups who want to innovate in this space. And since you've seen innovation from A to Z, what do you think are the biggest challenges? Like if I'm a startup right now, I'm going to come and create a Gen AI tool that helps to summarize the medical record. What are the hurdles or the challenges you think I'm going to face? And why would you think that XYZ hospital would not adopt this tool?
Yeah, I think this is the piece where we're all battling and we're all trying to understand how are we going to use AI. I think we are at the peak of the expectation hype curve. You know, if you've seen that Gartner.
Yes, exactly.
Cycle,
the dot com boom.
Of inflated expectations, right? Sam Altman and Arianna Huffington just published something in Time last week. I don't know
about
if you read
health.
That.
Yeah.
The whole, about Thrive Health and everything
exactly.
Like that.
The coach.
And so, you know, health coaches, and I'm reading that and I'm thinking, like, it sounds great. But then ultimately there's motivation. And anyway, how are you going to implement that into your hospital? So how does a hospital do this? We are all dipping our toes into it. We have to be very mindful of how we do these things. You know, I think we've all put AI in the back end. So we are working with a startup. It wasn't through Halo Health, but it was a Canadian company called Semantic AI. And we did, it helped us with our coding, our back end coding, which is a very manual process for submissions to the ministry. We were able to leverage Semantic's work to be able to improve our coding and increase the number of charts that we're able to code by our physical human coders. A first pass, finding increased HIG weights as well, which is something that you can do to submit to the ministry to reflect the unique work that you do here at SickKids. And how did we do that? It was through a tool that was introduced to us. It's to meet with CMIOs, to give the value proposition, and coming to the hospital, not with a solution, but understanding the problem they're trying to solve. So, you know, it's always that, you know, I have this great tool that will do this, 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 and do, but is it my problem right now? So it's that dialogue, right? It's understanding what is the priority of the hospital. What is the priority of a pediatric organization? What is the priority of an adult hospital organization? And it's really understanding what those clinical workflows are. So making sure that you've done your privacy impact assessments, threat risk assessments. What is your data stack look like? Have you considered interoperability? We don't want to do pilots. We are piloted out. We get all these options to say, we'll partner with you to come up with a solution. They want to use our hospitals as sort of dev shops. And you know, we've got limited resources. We've got things to do ourselves. So, you know, it's very difficult to partner to be able to do some of these things. So the barriers are really going to be understanding what the hospital organization's priorities are, and then marrying those two as well. So we are dipping our toes with some early stage companies, but we would want to work with somebody with a proven track record because we have limited resources. So it's really important for us to allocate those appropriately.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I've seen this like tons of times, like, and that's where the gap is. And I think that's what Halo Health is trying to do, is like approach that gap. There's a gap between clinicians and technologists, coders, programmers, software developers, and they come with a solution. But the question is like, is this the solution for the problem that do I have? And that always makes me talk about also like customization in healthcare. And it's very important to customize your solution to the problem that the hospital have before going and offering solution for a problem that doesn't exist in the first place. But I completely agree with you. It's just like having a track record and talking from understanding the hospital's problem before offering a solution. I want to switch gears a bit, so just for the sake of time, I want to talk about you becoming a member of Halo Health. And so when you became a member of Halo Health as a physician, what were your hopes? Like, what did you expect from this organization, or how you can contribute to it, and how Halo Health can contribute to you?
So I love the advisory part of it. And mm-hmm. You know, I have limited time in my hands, but, you know, I wanted to allocate it to Halo Health, which brings together like-minded clinicians, like-minded physicians, to be able to look at the startup world, and we'd be able to do that early pass to be able to say, yes, this has something or this doesn't have something. Because I think it's really important to be able to say, this is a good idea and this is not such a good idea, and let's cut our losses. And you know, I would not suggest that you go forward with this, because mm-hmm. I think it gives the startup person some good feedback. I've invested in a few things, haven't had very many exits yet, but invested in a few things. And so that's been really important for us to be able to do. And I think it's a great environment. I think it's a great networking opportunity as well, because that's what we need to do in Canada. We need to foster innovation as well. I think in Canada, it's less robust than it is in the US from a funding opportunity. I think trying to get additional funds to be able to do it. If you read some of the work from, you know, Jim Balsillie and some of the other early tech investors and inventors, what's happened with Shopify is really, really great as well. So we've got these things, but we don't want people to go into the US, but the market is 10 times larger as well. So lots of competition out there. So yeah. I've been really happy with my involvement with Luke and Halo Health. I think they've done a great job in engaging our clinicians as well.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's an environment I really love. I really love their events that they hold, like in Toronto. I'm in Detroit, but I drive to Toronto literally for one night sometimes just to attend the event, because it's a huge networking. Like, you are meeting people who are like-minded, and it's great. You see people in real world. And that brings me to the next point. Like, investing in startups is investing in people, because you want people who want to achieve and get feedback and listen to that feedback. And I want to go back a bit. You mentioned that you invested in some startups. Like, when you invest in a startup, like, what are the three or four criteria? Of course, there are many, but what are the three or four main points that you look for? You say, okay, so this is safe, it passes my checklist, or I will pass on this opportunity.
Yeah, I think you have to understand what they're trying to do. You have to look at the what's happening in the world, what's happening with genomics, what's happening with communications interoperability, and to be able to say, is this something that I understand, that I think has merit? Sometimes these things will work and sometimes they won't. You're right. You know, sometimes the technology is too early and sometimes management is not ready. And so you're investing in people, you're investing in the management and looking at the track record of the people who have who are involved in that company as well. So it's a multifaceted investigation and analysis of whether an investment is right for you. And it's based on your risk profile. So, you know, there's an old adage of how do you make a small fortune in biotech? You start with a large fortune.
You know, so, that's right.
Right.
Fair enough. Yes.
You know, so you have to be careful as well. So, you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket.
Yes.
As you know, only like 1 in 7 sort of early stage venture cap are going to hit. But they should make up for your losses. So very important for you just to diversify and be able to do that appropriately. And it's not for everybody. And sometimes physicians and healthcare workers make the poorest investors because we're sometimes too trusting. So Halo Health has also helped us with trying to improve our financial acumen, and the ability to analyze companies. So that's been really valuable. Lots of resources and tools.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think as physicians, we bring that understanding of the clinical problems and maybe a solution a bit. But we need help when it comes to understanding finance, especially like in the startup world. It's completely different. So you mentioned that it is not for everybody. Let's say like I'm a physician and I listen to this. And though like investing in startups sounds good because like, you know, lots of physicians invest in real estate and stocks, and investing in startups is not something that we usually get exposed to. So what advice would you give a physician to learn more about this type of security, and what should I do next to learn more about investing in startups, and how should I allocate my money and my finances?
Yeah. So I think, Ruben, I think, you know, go to the Halo Health website and look and see what resources they are. I think the membership is very minimal. And I think you can get a lot of value from that. So really important for us to be able to do that. There are tech incubators that you could look up. But if you don't have the time for that, then just invest in a healthcare ETF potentially. You know, you may want to do that, and you know you're using one of the ETFs to be able to do that.
Yeah.
So sometimes that'll work. You know, in the genomics world, there's some ETFs there that you can look at. Because I think that's going to be the real future is precision child health and precision medicine, being able to provide that with genome sequencing. You know, you've got the CRISPRs of the world as well. So I think starting with Halo Health is a good, very good solution for that.
Amazing. Great. Thank you so much. That brings us to the end of the episode. And thank you so much. I really appreciate your valuable time. This was very informative. And I'm sure everyone who listens to this, there are many things to learn. And thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Rupen, and best wishes and good luck in your future endeavors.
Thank you.